Andrew, good day and welcome on the podcast. How are you?
Good, Jay. Good to see you again.
Thank you very much for joining. I've kind of changed my interview style in a way, and you'll know lots more about this than I do, but I want to go straight into a specific subject. I was lucky to be a guest on your pod a couple of years ago, and you are running a community of investors, essentially, and you look very, very closely at investing in certain types of companies. What are those companies? What are the kind of returns you're looking for? And we'll just have a look at that first, and then we'll get into the Bitcoin side of things. Because what I essentially find fascinating is people that love investing in companies that have begun to love investing in Bitcoin, and like why that is.
Yeah. Well, look, I'll be a bit crass. The reason for the obsession and focus of investing in shares was, for the longest time, it was the best asset class, right? Mm. And also, I mean, so you come from for the money. Let's just be honest about it.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
You know, and not in just because, in a base kind of way, but just in a money is an incredible tool for freedom, and so you know you want to accumulate as much as you can to live the life that you want to live, and to be able to be an agent for good in the world is the way I would sort of frame it. But it's something that as you start getting into it, it's just like, oh, I want to make some money. Shares look like they're the best asset class. Okay, I want to buy something where the share price is going to go up. Why do share prices go up? And that is a very deep rabbit hole. Like, why indeed do share prices go up, right? And you can give very simple explanations. You can give very deep explanations. But it set me, at least, and I think for a lot of the people I know who have really gotten into this, it's just an incredibly intellectually stimulating arena. Whereas even if I had $1 billion, I would probably still be a direct investor because it's fascinating. Because to answer my earlier question, why do share prices go up? Well, you've got to have a pretty good model of the world to be able to sort of reliably, at least to a reasonable degree, do that, right? Mm. And so it's just fascinating. And the whole idea with what we do is just to sort of say, well, look, the market is wide open. There are people who invest for income. There are people who invest for growth. There are people who invest in large caps and small caps. And we didn't really set out with any particular agenda, but the community at Strawman very much moved towards the small cap area of the market. And it's definitely where my passion lies. And I think the reason for that is that it's undercovered. So you're not up against the so-called, and I use this term sarcastically, heavily dripping with sarcasm. it's an area where the smart money doesn't tend to go, because there's generally liquidity profiles aren't great. So if you're managing a $100 million fund, you know, it's hard to put $10 million to work in a company whose entire market cap might be $20 million, for example. So it means that you've got less competition. You've also almost by definition got a lot more upside because they're smaller companies, right? So they, you know, and every big company was a small company. So I think we kind of sort of gravitated towards that area. And the idea with it really was, see, I used to work for, I've worked for brokers, I've worked for investment newsletters, I've worked all over the place, but my job has largely in the space been one of providing what is called general advice. Hey, I like this stock for whatever reason. And I worked out pretty quickly that actually you'd sort of form these opinions and then you'd get a lot of pushback from those that you were providing the advice to, not in a critical way, but in a constructive way. And I think it's very natural to push back against that. There's a million opinions in the share market. There always will be. And there'll always be an opinion that's opposite to yours. But I found that for my investing, leaning into that was incredibly powerful because, you know, we naturally seek confirmation bias, and it's really great when someone says, yes, your idea is brilliant, aren't you smart? But if you really want to make money, the better form of engagement is someone who says, listen, you may have missed something here. And so the idea of the community was to, hey, let's have a platform where people can share ideas and we can track those ideas so we can sort of develop a sort of a social proof around that. And also to challenge those ideas. And one of my favorite ideas is that the best way to improve an investment idea is to challenge it. You either realize that it's flawed, in which case you avoid losing money, which is one of the best ways to increase your average returns, or you strengthen your conviction, which is an incredibly almost necessary thing if you want very big outsized gains, because markets are volatile, right? Mm. And when you know what you own and why you own it, volatility is a real gift. So that's a long rambling answer. I may have gone off the mark there a bit, but that's kind of what.
No, I love it. There's so many things I can ask about. Specifically, though, maybe even more context, if you will. So when you were working for a broker, what was that like, as either job on a day-to-day basis? How were you guys making money as brokers, and what was the type of information that you were trying to show people?
So this is going back a long way, and I'll date myself a little bit here, but the first job I had was with a very large, well-known online broker, probably the first major one in the country. And when the internet first, it sounds crazy from the perspective of 2025, when the internet first came about, people were very skeptical of doing anything with money online, like shopping online, banking online, buying online, shares online. Like, it's just risky. What can go wrong with all of that kind of stuff? And so I really just, I actually, my degree was in microbiology of all things. And I applied for this job because it was just there and I needed some cash. And so I was completely new to this. I'd never done any major economics or any finance. At the time, they were so desperate for staff. It was like, can you fog a mirror? You've got the job, right? Not like there was a high threshold. And I just lucked into it. And I lucked into it at a time where the online broking sector just exploded. So as long as you weren't completely incompetent, you sort of got carried along with that.
Mm. Yeah, good market to get into at the right time.
Oh, yeah. It's all about timing with so many things, right? And it was complete luck. But I kind of got, well, there were two observations. The first was, it's a soulless, almost evil kind of industry, right? Like so many middleman industries, you know, there's a principal agent kind of problem, right? What's best for the client? Well, that's one thing. What's best for us, the broker? I use the word us very generally here, but you want people to trade. You want people to trade their pants off. Buy, sell, buy, sell. That's how your broker makes money, right? You don't make money by having a client who buys a
couple of trades a year.
Yeah, that's not what you want. So I got quite disillusioned with that. And I also, you know, I started off just on the phones executing orders and then sort of moved up into an industrials research team. And I really distinctly remember the boss I was working with at the time. We'd spent a lot of time putting a research report together on a company, and it was a buy recommendation. It was a strong buy recommendation. And I remember being excited about it, and that there were laws or rules, appropriate rules, at the brokerage, which was you can't front run your clients, right? Like, so you can't buy this until you've, I think it was a week after you've released the research report.
Wow, interesting.
And just one of those water cooler chats was like, oh, how much are you guys going to buy? We'd spent a lot of time working on this. And I was bullish on it, right? And I remember others in the team were like, oh, none. And to me, it was just such an epiphany. It was like, wait a second, we're telling people that this is a great investment. We're putting our name behind this. Why not? It wasn't very necessarily, you know, people just had different priorities. I guess people were trying to buy houses, all of that kind of stuff. But it made me realize that, you know, you were really in the game of selling certainty. Is what you're really doing, because that is the big thing everyone's trying to overcome. I just want to buy. I just want to make a bunch of money. Tell me what to do. It's all very scary and volatile. And what you really do when you package it up as in the industry is you're offering some kind of certainty. I'm a fund manager, and I'm going to give you some assurance that I'm going to deliver a good return. I'm a stock tipper, so I'm going to tell you that this is a stock that's going to give you a good. I'm trying to do that. And honestly, what really matters there isn't the quality of your advice, because there's a sucker born every minute. And there's a huge amount of churn within any client base in this field. So it's just, it's more important to sound good than to be good in a lot of ways. So I got very disillusioned with the whole thing. And you can see it in the data, Jake. Like, you know, most active managers underperform after fees. Like, fact, right? What does that tell you? But at the same time, underneath all the rubbish and all the garbage, there are absolutely some very capable, smart people out there who have got a good process, who have got good results, who are getting good results not through luck, but by course of their thinking, their framing, their research, their process, all of that. And that was very exciting to me, that it's it wasn't just a crapshoot. It's like, you can, if you're smart enough and clever enough and hardworking enough and you've got the right mental models, you can actually reliably make good money. And that was intoxicating to me. And so this process, it's like with Bitcoin, right? The process never ends. And, you know, any time in my career I've thought, yeah, I've got it figured out, it's usually been that pride before fall moment. So you're forever learning. But it's sort of like, you,
yeah,
and it's
staying
like,
humble,
it's
like, is hard.
It's staying humble is hard, right? And yeah. but like anything, whether it's playing the piano or basketball or whatever, the more you do it, the better you get at it. And the better you get at it, the more you enjoy doing it, and the better the returns are. It compounds. And so here I am, you know, gosh, almost 30 years after first sort of getting involved in the industry, and excited and passionate about it as ever. It's just that this damn yellow magic internet money coin came along and sort of derailed everything.
It's so
unintentionally.
Well, and you get the bug. You're like, hang on, what is this thing? And you talk about things like growth. You talk about things like income. You talk about things like risk. And you're like, you start reapplying some of the models that have worked for you in the past. And it's like, well, in some cases, the model's just broken because it's just a completely different thing. And in other cases, the model says it's the best thing in the goddamn world. And you're like, well, hang on, what do we do here?
Yeah.
Before we dive into the bullish Bitcoin side of things, so I always love learning more about how people picked up skills in their lifetime that help them then see value themselves. And yep. So some context here being, I did some angel investing in 2017, 18, 19. And initially, I knew I wanted to get involved in buying equity in early stage startups. And I was going around looking myself, and I would go to like university campuses in London and listen to lectures and see what companies were coming out of their accelerator programs. And I quite really, well, it wasn't even that fast. It took me about half a year to realize that without making a single investment, I didn't have a clue what I was doing. And you're like, well, hang on, is this a good idea or a bad idea? How much money do you even put into these things? How long should the runway be after investments made? And there was more questions than answers like achieved. And in some ways, it's a good story because you just got to throw yourself in there and figure it out.
Yep.
But I came across a syndicate. It's called the Green Angel Syndicate. At the time, I was looking for clean tech companies specifically. Mm. And I joined as a member, paying an annual subscription fee of a few hundred pounds. Wasn't a lot to join. There was some accreditation required in order to be a community member around like being sophisticated investors and things like that, which is quite common in a lot of places in terms of regulation. Mm. But I was able to then sit in a group of people that were ex-venture capital partners or they were ex-entrepreneurs. And by the time, I think when I joined, there was only about 25 angels in the group. And 3 years later, there was already 100.
No.
So suddenly you had this cool thing where there was obviously a growing market of interested investors. The syndicate became the smart money to go and try and get some very early stage funding from. Plus the expertise and the network of some of those people that could become non-exec directors for the young founders, et cetera.
Yep.
And I found that awesome. And I will do it again at some point, but essentially Bitcoin came along and just like, I was like, wow, this is the best early stage investment you can make.
Yeah.
But with the same risk reward profile, with the same downside risk, like a bond, it's like, it doesn't make sense. Like, what the hell is going on here?
Yeah.
But teach me more about Strawman and what it means to be a community member there. And so these companies, are they listed businesses?
Yep.
I.e. they're liquid. Okay.
Yep.
And do you focus on, it's all ASX stuff.
Yep.
And is it specific industries that you're looking at? You're just all sharing due diligence the whole time on what you're looking at? Because I love that kind of stuff. I'm not doing any of it right now.
Yeah. I mean, it's very selfish reasons really why it started. I wanted a source of ideas and I wanted to tap into a wider brain trust. I think anyone who's been involved in a community like you've been, you have to sort of experience it to understand it. Is just that, you know, no matter how smart or capable or the resources you have, no matter how good they are, there is something to be said of getting a group of like-minded people together who are on a similar mission, who can share their thinking, their experience, and sort of challenge and stress test ideas. It's just so incredibly valuable. And so, there's no mandate for us. It's ASX only at this point in time. We give everyone the way that we sort of track it. Well, I'll go back a step.
You articulated a powerful point. it's about the value.
My AI thinks I'm talking to it.
The future of podcasting.
That's right. You should have said this. So what was I saying? So look, whenever I meet an investor, I really want to know two things. What do you own and why? That's kind of what I want to know, because that tells me everything about what you're thinking. Yeah. And so there's no really good places, I don't think, to do that online. There's Twitter, there's Hot Copper, and there's forums, but they're very shouty. It's full of trolls and bad actors and shills and pumpers and just, you know. So one of the things that we do is that we give everyone $100,000 play money, and you can go and buy anything on the ASX you want. You know, whatever style, whatever strategy, anything goes. And the idea being is that quality will out over time. If you know what you're doing, that'll probably be reflected in your performance. And when I look at your profile, Jake's on Strawman, here he is. I can see your biggest positions. I can see what trades you're making. I mean, I know instantly what your favorite stocks are and what you're thinking about them, because I can see what trades you're kind of doing. Now it's play money, and play money is different to real money. I get that. But I don't have the funds to give everyone $100,000. So play money it is. But it is very valuable. And also we have these sort of collaborative company reports where anyone can add, we call them straws, you know, research notes or valuations to a company. And then that can be voted on. So I get this means to sort of aggregate what people are buying, what trades they're doing, what research that they kind of have. And then we can sort of just sort that according to endorsement and performance and all these other kind of ranking things. So I can look at our community of 500 odd members and go, that is the most popular company amongst all of our investors. And when I click on that, I can see, well, this is what the average valuation is. And this is what, you know, people say. And there'll be good things there and bad things. And we're all care, no responsibility, right? I'm very big on the idea that you can borrow an idea, but you can't borrow the conviction. And so we do not give advice in any way, shape, or form. We can't give advice, really. Like, well, I mean, you know, no one cares more about your money than you, but we can give you ideas and we can challenge those ideas and we can hopefully give you some new perspectives. And if we can do all of that, and if all the result of that is that you dodge one bad investment or you found one good investment that you wouldn't have otherwise come across, then hopefully the value proposition is quite material.
Awesome. And so do people pay like an annual subscription or something? Like, what's the actual business model for Strawman?
Yeah, so we're it's not cheap. It's $1,000 a year for our premium subscription. Anyone can create a free account, and that'll give you some limit. Like, if you want to have a play around with a play money portfolio and you want to see delayed information, it's only a month delayed. You see a lot of stuff on there. It's still pretty relevant, right? It's free. Cool. But the only revenue we take is from subscriptions. So we don't sell data. We don't sell mailing lists. We don't do anything that, because we want to make sure that we're aligned. We're probably leaving a lot of extra money on the table, but you know, I think it's important for us to have that alignment.
And the trade there is quite simple. It's like, if you did actually have $100,000 to put into Australian companies and you're like, well, what the hell do I do? And what I love about this kind of product, it's like, it's retail investor focused.
Yep.
So it's the average guy on the street who can scrap some money together, can set up an account. And it's like, that to me could be a very, very useful part of the toolkit when you come to making difficult decisions. Yep. At the end of the day, it's just you. And if you get it wrong, your $100,000's gone.
Yep.
So if you're not willing to spend $1,000 on a subscription to get like good information on what's going on out there, well, you probably shouldn't be investing in the first place. And that's why, like, you know, also, shout out to James Check, for example, writing his newsletter, and I pay the subscription for his Substack. It's just excellent information to help me just weather the storm of the battered hodler going like, what is going on?
What is the value
come on,
of Check, good information? Come on. Yeah.
Tell me
is
I'm the okay.
I 100% agree. I never give it. We don't do any marketing. I don't give it a hard sell. And we set the price pretty high. And we set it high for a couple of reasons. One is it's a self-selection mechanism. Like, if you're just playing around, you're not gonna spend $1,000 to join some online investment club. Get real. So you only get people who are really serious about it, and you only get the people who understand the value of it. So it's sort of
which makes the product better,
yeah. Right? And awesome. And it sounds like I'm shilling here, and maybe I am, but
no, you should because it sounds awesome. Yeah.
I lean in. It started off as, you know, when you're launching a business, it's like, oh gosh, that's a lot. How do I justify it? We launched the alpha build, really dodgy build, was like 2018, but we went to a paid model in 2021. Jeez, I should know that. But 2021, cool. I think. Peak of the small cap market, as it turned out. So the timing was just perfect. So, okay, so and it's one of those things too. It's just like, I've found it very valuable is when people say, oh, that's a lot, why should I join? And my answer is always, you shouldn't. But yeah, you know,
if you've asked,
like, you get it, you don't. No one walks into a Rolls Royce dealership and then tries to haggle on the price. And if you do, the dealer goes, see you later.
I'll take it.
You're in the wrong place. This is not a place for haggling, right? And it's just, and that's because Rolls can stand behind the brand. They recognize the value there, and a lot of people won't get it, and that's cool. That's not the market, right? If I need to convince you and talk you into this thing, you're not for us, right? Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. I like that. It's self-selecting. And so, okay, so one of the reasons that I'm not a straw man member is because I'm not spending any time whatsoever looking at 10, 12, 15, 20% returns on companies. I am looking at Bitcoin and multiples over, you know, fairly short time spans, to be honest, in terms of the timeline you need to hold for. So you've already touched on this, like this Bitcoin thing comes along. Take us through what, like, inevitably, everyone's got a bit of a story about when they first heard about it, like, yep, that's wrong, or whatever. But when you are clearly, you know, absolute expert at that space that you're operating in, and suddenly this new thing comes along, how does that kind of jive against itself?
Apologies to those who have heard it before, because I've told the story a few times. But
No, go for it.
Well, look, essentially, I was very dismissive of it when it first popped up. You know, it was a scam. What's the point? I remember being on a podcast and the guests were into it at the time and were asking me about it. And I was like, well, I can do that already with my bank. Like, why? I just completely missed it, right? And this is in 2017 or so. And then not long after that, the top of that market, things crashed and my view was validated. I thought it was a bubble. It popped. It's a bubble. Right, I can get on with my life now. This distraction is gone. What a bunch of idiots, right? And then we had the next run up, you know, post sort of COVID, and I was like, okay, bubbles don't usually reinflate, and it's done this a few times now. And people keep asking me about, because I'm in finance, and you know, I'm on sometimes on telly and radio, so it just keeps coming up. So it's like, well, I need to have an informed view of it. So I thought, well, I'll look at it. So the purpose being so that I can intelligently debunk it. Mm. And in the process of trying to debunk it, I orange-pilled myself is the short version. I was like, awesome. Oh, surely this is the gonna, you know, I'm new to Bitcoin and I'm here to tell you everything that's wrong with it. And then when you do that, if you seriously try to do that in an objective, open-minded way, you'll arrive at the conclusion that you and I, and I think anyone else who's genuinely done that, people have said before, no one has spent 100 hours looking at this thing and come away bearish. There's something in that, right? And that was me. Once that mind virus gets involved, it gets into your brain, it strengthens. And the other story I tell is that I spent decades working in finance without ever knowing what money was. Like, yes, it was, wow. Bitcoin's a teacher, right? Like, it's just... I just the very unit of account I just took for granted without ever thinking about that. Yeah. And it's overtaken. It is by far my largest position on Strawman and in real life. Recklessly so, probably should be said, at least against the traditional kind of thinking. And I'm still waiting for the killer blow. And I genuinely put it out there to all friends, because it's, you know, once you've swallowed the orange pill, you just annoy all your friends and family with it until they can't stand you anymore. But I'm always of the view, it's just sort of like, I get it. It's not for you. You don't like it. But I would love, and this is the straw man ethos, right? I would love nothing more than someone to say, Andrew, you're wrong, and here is why.
Here's why, yeah.
And I need that, because I've got a lot of money. A lot of my wealth is tied up in this thing. And if I'm wrong, I want to know I'm wrong. And yet all I get back are the usual tropes, you know, that it's sort of like that again, once you have in good faith examined them, you realize that actually it's not a risk. Actually, that's not a threat. You know, whatever, you pick 1,000 different types of FUD. And you and I have, and others who have gone down the rabbit hole, have looked at them one by one and gone, huh, that's not an issue. Oh, this is a problem. Government's going to ban it. Huh, okay, now the biggest government in the world is strategically holding it. You know, Wall Street and the biggest fund manager in the world are actively buying it. Like, you know, you kind of, everything that you come across, you just, you tick it off. And then the only rational conclusion to a process like that is if I can't kill this idea, it must be a good idea, right? Mm. And the other thing I'm very big on as an investor, whether it's shares or Bitcoin or Emu Fund or whatever, it's just like I'm very big on the idea of asymmetry. I want an investment because, any, by the way, Bitcoin could fail. Let's be real.
Yeah,
anything. Nothing certain in this life except death and taxes. And so it could absolutely fail. But if it does, okay, that'll suck. But I also need to put that against the potential upside. And this is the same with any equity. I'm looking for something that if it flips heads, I make 10 times my money. If I flip tails, I lose half my money or something like that. In other words, there's an incredible asymmetry that's involved. Because I can tell you with my equity investing, I've probably got a 55% strike rate at best. In other words, close enough to half of the stocks I'd like and buy don't do well. And yet my long-term average returns, I'm very proud to say, humble brag, they've been fantastic. And that's because of the asymmetry, right? Like I'm buying stuff. I know I'm going to be wrong, right? Because like I just, no one human brain can incorporate and synthesize all the information that's out there and clearly see the future. We just can't do that. So I'm going to be wrong. But if I'm wrong, I don't want to lose too much. And if I'm right, I want to make a shit ton, right? And that's the other thing you realize with Bitcoin is it's kind of like, well, it's either zero or many millions of dollars at the end point, maybe over decades. Mm-hmm. And now maybe you'd agree, maybe you'd disagree, but I think we're at a point where it's not even zero, it's not even on the table anymore. So it might remain niche and bespoke, sort of around this kind of level. Maybe there's a 50% downside if, I don't know, it's hard to envisage a situation, but my downside is limited. But the upside is pretty crazy. So it's kind of like, What's not to like here, right? High conviction, massive asymmetry, you know, low risk.
And that's where it's fun taking models that have worked for you in the past and reapplying them to this new thing.
Yes.
Like, okay.
Yeah.
Ah, lots that's of what I was overlap. Looking for in a company. But this thing isn't a company. What is this thing? And that obviously, the further you go down, this is true every time. The more you know, the more you buy.
Yes.
I haven't met a single person that isn't like that.
Have you ever met anyone, Jake, who's put a serious allocation into it and then changed their mind?
Not yet.
I have not, right? No. Like it's a one-way door.
And I do wonder these ETF outflows that happened in the last kind of 6 weeks or so. Like, is that in realistically big size? Is that certain players just speculating? I don't know. And that would be perhaps one example, because that is actually quite a major amount of selling that's actually happened.
Mm-hmm.
But not the retail investor, not the guys who are involved, and girls, I'm sure, in Strawman, for example, or these early stage equity investment group that I was part of. Like the people that get down this rabbit hole and start allocating, they sell some because life happens and you suddenly realize it's just money and you can sell it because, you know, I've got four times more purchasing power than 3 years ago.
Money's there to be spent, of course.
Yeah. So I'm not as like never sell your Bitcoin type person, but not from a strategic investment lens. I've never seen someone take a position and get rid of it in a serious way.
Yes.
And so that's a great question. Why I'd love to, this is what I'm trying to figure out generally speaking, is like, okay, if we take the idea that like Bitcoin is a given and you've got this sound money that you can build businesses on, the hurdle rate for a capital allocation now is different, right?
Yep.
It's like, okay, so you might come to me, I might join Strawman tomorrow and I might see 10 small cap companies that I like the look of. Well, are any of them going to outpace Bitcoin? And that some of them might have a capital growth potential to do that, in which case, great, I'm interested in those ones and those ones only.
Mm-hmm.
But what I don't think many people have realized is the counterparty risk. I've got to trust the information that Strawman's given me. I've got to trust the online broker that I'm using. I've got to trust the fact they're not going to shut down the stock market for some reason.
Got to trust the CEO. Got to trust the company.
Or the actual business itself to function.
Yep.
And that's just like this huge, huge black hole of risk that we've never really thought about when you can own Bitcoin in self-custody.
Yeah.
And so how do you see things playing out in the future? Like, take an example of some of these companies. They might have, you know, a really excellent engineer, CEO, who's come up with some cool technology that's genuinely making something 10x cheaper or faster or stronger.
Yeah.
They need capital, right?
Yeah.
These things aren't just going to grow with a bloke in a garage. You actually, you want smart money coming in and funding things.
Yeah, you bet.
But in an environment where the risk-free return is Bitcoin, how do you actually do that?
Yeah.
And I'd love to get your thoughts on that.
That's such a great question. I mean, the thing is with Bitcoin and its upside is that we're just at a very unusual point in history. When we look back in 1,000 years, there'll be a pre-Bitcoin and a post-Bitcoin era. And at a point of hyper-Bitcoinization, the thing won't be growing that much. It will probably grow broadly in line with productivity growth, much like gold behaves now, right? You know, it's going up forever, Laura, as Michael Saylor says, but it's not going up at 40% forever. Like the maths just breaks. The old saying is trees don't grow to the sky. So we're in this weird phase. When I say phase, this could last 10, 15, 20, 30 years. Yeah. Where we're going through adoption. What are we at, 3% global adoption? And we have to get to 90%, right? Pick your number. It's a low level of adoption. And during that adoption phase, that's where you've got the potential for material upside. So I frame it this way because it depends on what you're talking about. If you're talking about now as a capital allocator and hurdle rates, that is a big hurdle to get over, like definitely. Mm. At maturity, I think people will be very happy to fund companies because the upside return for Bitcoin won't be there and not to the same magnitude anymore.
Yes.
And maybe it's 30 years out in the future. So nothing you need to worry about now. In the here and now, though, yeah, I think it is increasingly difficult. I actually think it's a good thing, though. I think the capital is too easy at the moment.
Yep.
And why is that a problem? You think, well, isn't that good? Like, I want to start a business. Doesn't that give me more opportunity to create value and therefore jobs and economic growth and all of these good things? Like, yes, it does. But it gives you the opportunity, but doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to be successful. Look at all of the free money that was thrown out of the helicopter a few years back. You had stocks trading on, 30 times sales, and just capital was everywhere. And even on the stock market, no one cared about earnings. It's like, we just care about sales growth. And so you had all of this malinvestment that was there, and it just like that destroyed wealth, that destroyed things for us. I think we're materially poorer coming out of periods of excess investment and malinvestment being the important point here. And so having a higher hurdle rate it doesn't mean that no one will fund a business. If you come to me tomorrow, Jake, and say, oh, look, I've just cracked quantum computing. I've got a qubit here that's going to like revolutionize it. Would you like to fund it? I will sell a bunch of Bitcoin tomorrow to fund that because the upside is going to be massive on that. And by the way, there will always be those opportunities. Part of the reason I like small caps is because you've actually 10X, 5X opportunities are everywhere, right? Like it happened all the time.
Brilliant.
Even since I started investing in Bitcoin, I've had several investments outperform them, but the hurdle rate's a lot higher, right? So they're still there, but it just means that money is only going to go. By the way, people like me and you are in the minority here. So if the rest of the world's not thinking about this, so there is no shortage of capital to fund businesses. As the world continues to grok onto this, the hurdle rates will be higher, and I don't think it's a bad thing. Anyone who started a business, they do it partly because they have dollar signs in their eyes, but it's also because there's something that they're passionate about and they believe in and they think they can make the world a better place. That's not going to go away, right? And people will always, hubris is huge and ego is huge. People will always assume that their baby is going to go to be on the next Netflix or Nvidia or something like that. So people will always be, you'll always find believers in your cause. So I don't think it radically changes things, except that it will make investment into more frivolous ventures less likely. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah, it's actually quite crazy when you start thinking about the monster capital misallocation that's actually been going on in an environment where by printing more of the units of account, they think they're creating more value, but there's the same number of services and products out there. So that's not the case.
Can I elaborate on that? Sorry,
please,
Jake.
Please.
Just a little. It's worse than that because Here's the thing, right? Like I'm not too ideological on certain things, but the Keynesians have a point in theory, maybe in the same way that the communists have a point in theory, but they have a point in the sense that if you can put more money into the system when it is needed, and this is the big one, and you can invest that sensibly, it's not a bad thing. So if I expand the money supply, but I use that new money to create businesses that create even more value, then I can have an expansion of the monetary supply and increase prosperity. Mathematically, that's true. The problem with it is that it's not often spent the same. So we just, the Australian government just last night released their latest budget. We're $1 trillion in debt. Next year, we're spending $45 billion more than we have. The trouble is, we always do the deficit thing. We never do the surplus thing. We never balance it out. But the bigger problem, well, an equally big problem, is that it's not just that there's $45 billion that we don't have that we're spending. We're either borrowing for the future or we're just outright monetizing. Is that we're putting that into very low return or negative return ventures. That's what destroys value. And so when I say it's worse than what you say, it's worse for two reasons. It's worse because not only is the money going up, but all that money has been put into areas that are not creating value. In fact, destroying value, distorting the economy, interrupting the price signal, funding businesses that are sucking up, you know, the scarce resources with alternate uses, as Thomas Sowell would say, right? Like malinvestment takes resources away from where they're best used and use them somewhere where they're worst used. We're all poorer as a result of that. So sorry to go on a short rant there, but it's like, no, I'm agreeing with you, but it's worse than that.
And rants of what this is all about. Like it's like, what does fucking grind your gears? And that's what, in some ways, is how you build conviction, right? You're like, oh. I'll absolutely believe this to be true, that the most important vote you have is with your money.
Oh, yeah.
So by choosing to sell assets that are denominated in your local fiat currency and moving into Bitcoin, that is the biggest signal you can give to whatever malinvestment you might see going on.
Yep.
And, you know, we could get into like, what is the welfare state and like, what are taxes and all this kind of more libertarian stuff that I've grown to really enjoy. It's not I never studied it. I studied Keynesian economics, right? It's like, yeah, cool. We can play around with the interest rate. That helps with inflation. That will also help with employment. And then we're going to have extra growth. And then actually no one's even going to notice that we printed more money. Oh, Jake, 10 years later, shit, maybe they paid for the whole university. You know? Oh my God. Like, why did I get taught that?
Yeah.
And it took a long time. I mean, another thing I've said before as well is I was highly trained in how to make money, but not how to like ask the question, what is money?
Yes.
And so the day that you go,
we're all fishing in water, aren't we?
Yeah. What do you mean the denominator of everything is actually just losing value?
Mm-hmm.
And in particular, real estate, I think, is the best one for this, because it's like, oh, everyone's getting rich selling these houses. Yeah, sure. But you bought that house 2 years ago. You've done nothing to it but live in it. And now it costs 20% more.
Mm-hmm.
And you think that you added value. That doesn't make sense.
Yep.
But
how much money have we as a country wasted? I give the comparison to the Easter Islanders with the giant head statues. That's what we've done as a nation. We have created ungodly amounts of money through the banking system, and we've put it all into unproductive assets, i.e. houses. Mm. And we see it as a magic money machine that will create prosperity. I mean, houses are wonderful. They're the best thing ever because shelter is like one of the most important needs a human can have. And we all want a nice cave to live in, right? Of course. I've got nothing against property. Property is wonderful. I love property. But we've financialized the whole thing. And we've financialized an asset that doesn't produce anything. So that like money that could have been put into technology and factories and business and enterprise, things that make capital goods that are used to make other things. In other words, to increase our material wealth. We haven't done that. We've just put it all in houses. So it's a completely fake wealth. I say to my friends all the time, I've got friends who are in property and you're like, oh, my property's worth this amount. It's like, great, spend it. You can't. You either have to downsize massively. So, okay, you want to go and live in a tent. Now you've got a bunch of free capital you can spend that you didn't have. But presumably most of us like to like improve our lifestyle, not decrease it. So unless you're at the very end of life where you're downsizing, and even downsizers never really downsize if you know any boomers, right? Like they all say they're going to, but never do. So it's like, well, you're buying and selling in the same market, right? So it's sort of like there's that problem. Or you can use it, or you've got extra collateral to spend. But then that's just spending debt that presumably has to be paid back either through your earnings or, fingers crossed, through the ongoing appreciation of this non-productive asset. It's madness. It's absolute madness. And there'll be a reckoning at some point, I've got no doubt.
Yeah, and it's funny when you, I mean, even start to like peel back, I mean, specifically with real estate, it's the average income to average house price and how that, again, you know, what the fuck happened in 1971.com. Go and have a look. Just chart beyond chart beyond chart showing how the real standard of living has deteriorated in the last 50 years. And that's what's, I think, so excited about Bitcoin specifically. Like in your story, Andrew, that you tell today is not an uncommon one in this area that we're so passionate about. But like you just don't realize that by using the money that you were given, you're actually kind of, you're giving life to something that's making things worse for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, there's this new thing that, you know, sound money, no one's ever been taught about because it's a niche area of economics that they don't really like people knowing about because it means that the government can't spend whatever money it wants and inflate away the rest. It's a radically different world.
Mm-hmm.
I feel better from 4 years ago, having done a reallocation process, and now, to echo your point, ask a man what he owns, not what he thinks. Like, I want to see what your portfolio is.
Yeah,
that tells me everything.
Yep.
But like we're at the very early stages of a brand new world built on a different type of money. What does that mean to you?
You know, one of the first things, maybe not the first thing, but one of the things you start to realize after you've spent a bit of time in this space is that all the memes are true. Right? Like, And you
reminded stayed for me, the gains, came for the gains, stayed for the revolution.
100%, one of my favorites. So, yeah. So true. I love that. I love that. The other one is that Bitcoin fixes this. Because I remember I heard that at first and it's sort of like, oh, you know, it's like to the man with a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And these Bitcoiners have got this shiny new toy and it's just going to do everything. And then you start thinking about it. It's not a panacea that just solves every human problem. Of course not. But gosh, it fixes a lot of things. And like, it's such a big hyperbolic statement to say that to someone who hasn't looked at any or thought about these things independently or from first principles. It just sounds like bonkers, right? Like I thought people were bonkers. And then I'm at a point now where like I genuinely believe that the world, we will have less wars, we'll have less misallocation of resources, we'll have less grift. But like it looks from the outside that there's this big community of people who are just trying to win Lambo. When am I going to make $1 million? I'm going to buy this magic internet token and I'm going to be insanely rich and I'm not going to do anything for society. And look, let's be real. There is a chunk of people that is appropriate to. But by sort of sneakily coming into play, it really will. It changes the incentives. You know, Charlie Munger, show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcome. And when you change the incentives of money, the very tool, like I would put money as way up there with the wheel and fire in terms of what it has done for human civilization.
In great context as well, that, right? People don't really think about it in that sense.
No, but it is. It's an invent, or it's a discovery, perhaps is a better way to put it. But it just, without money, we don't scale as a civilization. We are in tribes of 300 or 400 people max. All right. Now we are in an interconnected global economy of 8 billion people. The short answer, money. So it's kind of a big deal. Like the fact that I can coordinate with someone, in fact, with literally thousands of people from around the world who I'll never meet, and I've got no idea if I can trust them. Doesn't matter. If I trust the money, we can interact and we can coordinate. In fact, we can do it in such a way that our revealed preferences will make sure that the allocation of resources is done in the most hyper-efficient way possible. It's an absolute mind blow of like a concept. And you sort of, and so when you start to realize and you know, the penny starts dropping on all of this, it's a big deal. And you want Bitcoin to win because you're probably against war and against grift and against corruption and against, you know, unfairness and against, let me, all of this cost of living stuff that's just not going away. I mean, who does it hurt the most? It hurts the poor. So I'll be honest with you, Jay. I'm a lefty from way back, right? I was in the uni days. I was the stinky hippie, smelling of something, handing out the green. Like, I'm so embarrassed to admit it, but I was young and I was idealistic and I was naive, right? And so I've got a lot of friends on the left, and unfortunately, they see Bitcoin as a thing of the right, and they see it's a Trump thing nowadays as well. So it's like they instantly dismiss it because of that political kind of stuff. But I keep telling them, if you're for the empowerment of the little guy,
fairness,
and fairness, who gets screwed over with inflation? It's the poor. I've got assets. If you've got property and shares and that, you're fine. Inflation, you're protected from it. Still sucks, but that's much less. You know, like if you're a wage earner with no assets, you are screwed. You have had a 30% pay cut since 2018 or something insane. Your savings have been eviscerated. Your earnings power has been eviscerated, and there's no silver lining. Someone who's got a portfolio, my share market's at a new record all-time high. I got a house. I'm doing fine. Like, how is that fair? How is that fair? How can you be on the left and be for that, right? Like, it's sort of like, stop treating this as a partisan kind of thing. This is something that is going to bring in an era of fairness, likes of which no political ideology has ever been able to do. And it's so hard to see. And again, I'm cringing as I say this because I've said it to so many friends and I just get that look of you've got two heads. But I genuinely believe it because money is so fundamental. It is so important. It touches every part of our lives. You know, and to think that we can now have a global money that is completely permissionless, is completely immutable, that is completely open and fair and transparent. Like it is the historians, you know, in hundreds of years will write back, this is a civilizational turning point. As big and profound, if not more so than the internet itself or the printing press or the Magna Carta. Again, big I know how this sounds. Deal. It's a big fucking deal. Yeah, and all of those things were laughed. All of those things were laughed at. Like, I forget the saying, but it's like transformational technologies are always overappreciated in the short term and underappreciated in the long term. So something comes along, it's like, this is huge, and the advocates go, it's going to change the world, and then it just doesn't happen as quickly as we expect, and it all sort of falls away. And then in the long term, it turns out that no, this changed.
They're right. Yeah.
They were changed. There was a world pre-electricity, there was a world post-electricity, there's a world pre-steam engines, post-steam, you know, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And Bitcoin is way up the top of that list.
Mm. Oh, I can feel your passion and excitement and energy literally coming through. It's absolutely awesome. And again, that's not uncommon, right? You turn into a kind of advocacy machine. My orange pilling attempts have slightly changed over the years. I think initially I was When I first really got into it, I'm like trying to tell literally everyone, and now I'm not nearly as aggressive with it in a sense.
Do you know before I said all the memes are true, have you seen the meme with the metronome and it's clicking back and forward? And on one hand, it's like, oh my God, I have to tell everyone I know about Bitcoin. It's so important. And then it's fuck them on the other side. And that's where I go in my orange village. It's like, I've got to tell you. I'm like, oh, fuck you.
I can relate to that. What I was intrigued to think through, though, is that like when you actually go back to the Communist Manifesto and the very early days of like the left, they want a central bank. It's literally in there that we control the money supply. It's no surprise to me at all that it's labeled as a right thing, because the actual communists are like, no, we want to run the money ourselves. Mm. And Bitcoin is an independent monetary network for peer-to-peer cash. Is not part of that Communist Manifesto at all. It never will be, and it never can be, according to the guy that wrote the bloody manifesto. Yes, however, I do think it's true that some of the what's the right way of saying it? This is not the right way. The features of being a leftist, but like some of the topics that they care about are solved by Bitcoin.
Yes.
So putting the central banking conversation aside. Which I think, how can you miss that? I think there is a podcast called Bitcoiners, Progressive Bitcoiners or something.
And the Progressive Bitcoiners. People around there. I think it was the guy who wrote The Progressive Case for Bitcoin, which is a good book I often recommend to a lot of my friends.
Really? Interesting. Yeah. So if you had a left-leaning friend, you could show them that.
Yeah, so like if you care about the issues on the left. You should care about this, right? Like, stop. And unfortunately, and this is not to throw shade at the libertarians at all, but I just, I mean, they're the ones who have seen it first and seen it most clearly. So again, if you're not of that political leaning, those associations can be damaging, just in terms of people's preparedness to have an open mind. Because when you say to me, hey, there's this thing, Bitcoin, and if I instantly go, that's a libertarian thing and I'm not a libertarian, that's it. It's a non-start. I'm not going past that point. And I don't even want to get into the debate, because for me, it's pan-political. It's beyond politics, right? I think you can be right-leaning and love Bitcoin, and you can be left-leaning and love Bitcoin, right? It's for everyone. And it's just one of the things I try and push back on in our community is that, because I would say, you know, of the people I encounter, I'm sure you find it the same, at least 80, 90% sort of be right-leaning, which is fine. I just wish it wasn't as much about that. Like, have your politics, but we don't have to make Bitcoin about your politics. Not because it's not relevant and it's perfectly relevant to you. I'm going to really be careful here. I don't want to tell anyone what to think in terms of their political leanings. But if you're here for the revolution, as we said, we need it to be for everyone. And by putting a particular color flag over the top of Bitcoin, we hurt the mission and no one's better off, right?
In all the hours of research I've done, I have become more libertarian, and studying Austrian economics has helped me hugely to understand value and like what's going on around me and the idea of self-interest and human action.
Oh, yeah. Oh,
this actually makes sense.
Yep.
But I listened to a podcast recently with Ben Ark, with Peter McCormack. I mean, it's probably maybe 3 to 4 months old now, but specifically talking about Noster and how that's been developed. Oh, yeah. And it's come out of basically a bunch of Lightning devs looking at marketplaces online, and they've, you know, you now got a Noster key and you've got your MPUB and NSEC, and the way that you send information is now very much more in the user's hands. Can't be switched off. Social media is kind of the initial use case, shall we say.
Yep.
And where he was so interesting about it was, as a left-leaning political thinker, he's like, what people are missing is this is the fair and open town square that people have been looking for.
Yeah.
And so this isn't about a private company owning a social media platform. This is like anyone can come here and say whatever they want, and it's the ultimate fair playing ground.
Yep.
And it's using the digitally native Bitcoin token that is also the most meritocratic form of money that's ever existed.
Yep.
And so how someone on the left side of politics can't, it's probably because, let's say, 10% of Bitcoin related content is left leaning at most. And so maybe that, and this is what it all comes back to. It's basically the quality of information that passes through a market is different to different people at all times.
Yep.
And that's what the straw man's all about, right? It's about higher quality information that helps people make better investment decisions. And it's the same thing when you're researching Bitcoin. It's the same thing when you're trying to pick up what political leaning you might have. Does any of that resonate?
Yeah, I mean, it does. And again, I've got to be clear here too, because, you know, you say one thing and people interpret it in a particular way. And I'm not trying to have a go at any kind of political thought. And I have very much embraced the Austrian school of economics, right? Like, I'm a latecomer to it, but I'm all in on it, right? I think it's just a much more sound, rigorous kind of framework to think about the economy. But it's just, we are political animals. We will always be political. As soon as you've got two people in a room, there's politics straight away, right? And the more that you expand that out, there's always going to be a feature of our species, of our civilization. That's fine. My only point is to not to tell anyone what to think, just to keep Bitcoin separate from your ideology, particularly if you're trying to orange pill someone. Because if you're coming at it from an angle that ostensibly resonates with a particular ideology, you're just not going to get a receptive audience to it. And I think that's the best way. You find out where people are at. What are the issues? I got a really close friend I went to school with. He works for a union, right? Big lefty. Love him to bits. He was always against it because of the environmental stuff and for some of the political stuff. And now he's just setting up his SMSF. He's putting all of his money into Bitcoin.
Awesome.
And the reason was because rather than preach to him some asinine dimension of Austrian economics or, you know, my particular worldview. It's just like, hey, if you care about the environment and the build out of renewables, you should really look at Bitcoin because it's actually massively positive on that. And here's a bunch of research. I'm sending Daniel Batten stuff, right? It's brilliant. Love it. He's like, oh, I didn't like, you know, and oh, by the way, you're against crony capitalism? Me too. That sucks. I'm a massive capitalist. I'm massively anti-crony capitalism. Are you against that? Hey, this fixes it as well. And then just to my point, I don't know, I'm probably laboring the point too much, but it's because I, like you, Jake, I listen to a lot of podcasts in this space, right? And it's an area of frustration for me that too often a particular worldview or ideology is stitched up with Bitcoin. I just don't think it helps the cause. Leave it to the side.
The point is Bitcoin's a tool.
And yes.
You could use Bitcoin to send money to someone to be a, you know, like a sex slave, or you can send someone money to buy your grandma a present.
Yeah.
Like, it's just a tool. Like what you choose to do with it is, you know, up to you.
It is entirely
and therefore, it's
impossible.
Not political itself.
You can have an entire welfare state. If you wanted to be, I'm all for the welfare state. I'm a big believer in welfare. It's like, cool. Bitcoin works in that system too. It depends how you want to raise it and allocate it, but you can. It's not mutually exclusive. By the way, I'm not advocating for that. I'm just using it as an example, right? Or I want to live on an abandoned oil platform in some, you know, sovereign individual libertarian utopia. It's like, cool, you can do that too. Because money is for, like, the internet is for people of all stripes, and so is money, and so is Bitcoin. That's my point. Mm.
No, it's a good one. It's funny though. So we'll wrap up very soon, Andrew. But a point that really made a difference for me when I was thinking about a lot of this kind of politics stuff is really around how politics eats, and it eats from a trough that it controls the money supply from.
Mm-hmm.
And it just makes so much sense in a world in which someone can't print money, because everyone's basically like, no, we don't want to use a money that someone else can just get for free and we have to work for it. That doesn't work any longer. Sorry, I'm out. Yep. And I'm going to choose this other thing. So not only is inflation used as a stealth tax on a population, but equally the way that the debt is used to then finance, you know, federal and state governments in different countries, like that's going to come under much closer scrutiny. And with that, the way that politics is funded is radically changed forever. Now, it hasn't yet happened.
No.
But I wonder, like, whether or not people will have such strong political affiliations in the future, because there just won't be as much to talk about.
Mm.
It won't be as political as it is currently. I don't know if that's true, but it's certainly when the funding of it changes, which will happen, at least in the world I see in the future, it has to be different to what we see today.
I hope so. I mean, look.
Like the whole shouting at each other thing is just absolutely pointless.
Oh, it is pointless. What am I trying to say? So the budget's been released this week. So I've been following it a lot. And I was in the car the other day, and a senior economist for a big think tank, he also writes regularly in one of the major mastheads, was on the radio saying deficits don't matter. And maybe there's some subtext there, not over a short period of time and not when the money's used in productive ways would be the one exception where I could kind of see some sympathy with that. But
I think that's very generous.
I am being generous, but it's sort
that's
of
very
like,
generous. It's like deficits don't matter to you, mate, because you get paid.
Yeah. Well, I just think it's so hard to see action and consequence because they are separated by such vast amounts of time, and so many different consequential steps along the way. So it's like, we should have more defense. It's like, yep, probably should. World's a scary place. Well, let's just spend $20 trillion on this submarine. You know, okay, cool. Education is good. Yeah, I'm for education. We should spend more money on it. Yep, we totally should. Wouldn't it be good to have state-of-the-art healthcare available to everyone? 100%. So all of these things, defense, health, education, massive. I like roads. I like stable society. I like a well-functioning, non-corrupt police force. Like, these are all good things. But what a hard money does is it just forces upon us hard decisions, because they are hard decisions. In the current system, we can ignore the reality of our choice by thinking that by conjuring up money, and it's done in a very roundabout way, and in a way, I guarantee you could question our most senior politics, really question them on it, and they'll just reveal that they actually don't understand where it all comes from, like fundamentally get it. They don't. I don't think anyone thinks they're being dumb, right? They're traveling along with the established orthodoxy. But by pretending that we can have our cake and eat it too, even this economist here is like, you're actually undermining yourself. You're undermining the fabric of society. You're putting inflation onto yourself, right? You might be better positioned to withstand that, but you're not. No one outside of short-term self-interested groups, no one wins from this malarkey. No one wins from it. And so, again, you can allocate, you can structure society how you like and allocate resources how you like, but with a hard money, it just forces the reality of those choices. And one thing you learn as an investor very quickly, you should at least, is that one of the biggest conundrums is a thing called opportunity cost. If I spend money here, I don't have it anymore. I can't spend it there. We live in a world where I can. I can actually decide to buy all of these things, and actually, you know, I'll buy that as well. and that the resources don't exist. There's no extra resources because we create more money. So I don't know what my point is here, other than sort of saying,
well, no, it's kind of like Andrew, if I may, it's like the decision to, do you just sit in your Bitcoin or do you buy a small equity position in a company that might outpace it?
Yeah.
And it's or, the governments now have a hurdle rate.
Or do I go put it in the pokies? Or do I go splurge it on jewelry or something? I don't know.
Imagine that. We're going to do 20 trill on pokies.
Right? Like, there is an opportunity cost. So the point that I'm always banging on about, and this is the debates that are happening right now in the press. Should have the government spent more money here or there? And it's like, well, you can have that debate. We should have that debate. But it's just, you can't have that debate without saying, well, where does that extra, if we decide we need to put more money here, where are we taking it from? Or where are we raising it from, right? Like,
what's
like
the trade-off?
What is the trade-off? And we live in a world where the established orthodoxy and the most high-ranking people in finance and government believe that, I don't think it's as craven as people like to imagine. I really think it's naivety and a misunderstanding of the fundamental way in which all of these things kind of work. But they believe that we can do all of this kind of stuff. And when asked about the long-term consequences, it's always a shoulder struggle. Don't worry. It's the Christine Lagarde. It'll work out. But why? It'll work out. And like, when things are good, we'll take some of this money out of the system again and we'll build up a surplus for next time. Like, even point to a period of time where that's ever happened on a sustainable basis, right? So
it hasn't. Now, my frustration with modern government is just the lack of accountability. It's like all these decisions that get made and then it's like, okay, it didn't go as we planned. Okay, yep. Well, are you going to lose your job or lose your pension or what? Yep. And just nothing, right?
No consequences.
My ultimate gripe.
It's not just that, but often the gap between decision and consequence can be years. You know, yeah. I'm the Treasurer of Australia. I think this would be a really good policy X and I'm going to do it. And then what you tend to see, usually if you're a politician, you're announcing something because it's going to win you votes. So there's a bunch of people are going to be happy with that decision. By the time that decision has resulted in a negative adverse outcome on a net basis, it will either, probably both. One, it'll be quite a distance between those two things. And two, it'll be very non-obvious. So it's a very easy thing to kind of do at the moment is to just make big promises, sound good. If it doesn't turn out, it'll be well into the future before anyone figures it out. And they probably won't connect the dots between that and my decision in the first place anyway. So it's a very easy thing to do. And that's why Bitcoin is so important, just because it forces that discipline on it without being able to conjure money out of thin air. We can have a whole discussion on whether fractional reserve still exists under a Bitcoin standard. I suspect it will, frankly, to some extent. But it severely limits that. And as a consequence of that, again, we can still decide to give everyone a universal income if we want, or we can be hardcore, full-on extreme capitalists, whatever end of the spectrum, I don't care. But the trade-offs are made apparent and unavoidable. And that's why it's such a good thing.
It's very exciting, isn't it? Andrew, I was taken back to the start of the conversation when you were teaching about what it was like to sit in a broking shop and basically punt information that you weren't putting your own money behind and the consequences aren't really your issue. You know what I mean? There's always someone a sucker. And it's the same thing with someone running a treasury of a government. It's like, this sounds great. Let's get some votes. 5 years' time, not my fucking problem.
Politicians aren't dumb. Like, we've got to remember. I mean, Yes, they're dumb. Okay. But not really. I think that's lazy. I think it's a lazy criticism. They're dumb if you measuring their decisions through the consequences, which is probably how you would measure it. But if you're measuring it through what matters to them and their incentive structure, is like, I want to get elected. So in terms of according to their goals and their incentives, they're incredibly savvy, smart people. Incredibly, like fast, like yeah. people yeah, like you and me are not the politicians.
Game they're
trying to play. We're not that smart in that domain, in that arena. So it's more complicated than that. And to say that this decision you're making is stupid, yes, but only in a way that doesn't have any bearing on my well-being and livelihood and potential. It's sort of like it's a mute point right from the beginning. Yeah. Anyway, I don't want to.
No, it's very easy as well to be the kind of armchair pundit, you know, from a distance.
Yeah. You know, one of the best things they ever did with budget, speaking of that, is that the ABC, I think it was a few years ago, they had a website where it was, here's the tax revenue expected for the next year. How would you spend it? Because, again, it's very easy to say, do you want more health? Yes. Do you want more this? Yes, 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 yes. What was cool about this tool was that you had to trade off things. You had to say, oh, yeah, I guess more defense is a good idea. Let's do that. Okay, cool. Where's the money coming from? I loved it as an exercise, right? I think that if it was one rule I could make for society to improve things. I would say the federal budget is always set at a fixed percentage of GDP. And you can spend it on whatever you want. You know, whatever you think is going to get you votes, whatever. Just like any money, you must operate within that restriction. And if there's excess spending to happen somewhere, it must be taken from somewhere else. I think that would enforce a lot more prudent decision-making and to the electorate make it much more obvious as to the trade-offs that are there and would inform much more balanced and sensible debate. But that's not awesome. The world we live in.
Well, Andrew, thank you so much for your time today. Is there anywhere that you'd like to send people to get in touch?
Strawman.com is probably the best way.
Perfect.
Yeah. Yeah.
Awesome. Well, Andrew, thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate learning from you.
Jake, it's like, oh, mate, honestly, when you reached out and said, do you want to talk Bitcoin? That was a strong, there was no parallel universe where I was saying no. And I could go for an extra 3 hours, which just shows you how much I love talking about this.
But next time we will. Thank you. Thank you,
I really appreciate the opportunity. Thank you.